The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, Richard Oliva, who is semi-retired from his movie reviewing gig at the Catholic Journal Commonweal, returns to the show, this time with his list of worthwhile Christmas DVDs, ideally to be enjoyed while snow is gently falling. Richard also promises to return in January with reviews of three films with Catholic content, Lady Bird, Novitiate, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Back in a moment with film critic Richard Oliva.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Father Christmas, here's the meanest man in the old wide world, in the old wide world, you can feel it.
He's a miser. He's a skimpin'.
He's a stingy lout, leave his stocking out for your Christmas gift, and you steal it.
Welcome, Richard Oliva. Welcome back.
Thank you. And it's almost time to say Merry Christmas.
I know. And that's why we're here today. Yeah. The last time we talked, it was the Oscar roundup.
Yes.
But now we're going to help people with Christmas DVDs.
Yes. I wish I had like 100 to recommend, but I'm very picky about my Christmas viewing.
That's why we love you.
Yeah.
Why? Who wants to watch 100?
Yeah, it's not that I'm picky about movies in general, although I guess I am, being a critic, but I'm picky about Christmas itself. I'm a little bit annoyed by the American Christmas.
Which country's Christmas do you like?
Well, I tend to romanticize countries that I haven't been in. I've actually been in England, and since our Christmas more or less is descended from the English Christmas, granted, because of different ethnic groups, there's been some infusion from other cultures too, a great deal of infusion. But when it comes to just Christmas, it's mostly an English traditions, or at least an English feeling. I mean, nobody thinks, for instance, of Christmas in a hot weather country, although hot weather countries do have Christmas.
Yes.
In southern Europe, for instance, the big holiday is not Christmas, it's Easter. And that goes along with everything about a country like Italy or Spain, the hot climate, the idea of celebrations being more or less outdoors, in a garden, in the street, in your backyard. I think that goes along with something that's sacred in both Easter and Christmas, in that Easter is about a breaking out of confinement. Christ rises from the tomb. So he's out into life again, into open air. And something about that feeling is carried over into Easter, into the idea of resurrection. And Christmas is different. It just has these different traditions, different legends. You think of Christ being born in a warm little piece of confinement in the stable, or whatever it was that the legend has it. It may be in reality that the Holy Land was then actually in summer that Christ was born. We don't know. But our traditions all go to Northern Europe, not just England, but Northern Europe in general, because the Germans make a big, big deal out of Christmas and not such a big deal out of Easter, while the Italians and the Spaniards make a big deal out of Easter, and slightly less a big deal of Christmas. You know,
Sorry. Yeah,
go ahead.
Is there a parallel in the treatment of the holidays at Easter and Christmas in the movies?
You know, Easter hasn't really been celebrated that much in the movies. Yes, there are Easter films, but because if you're reconstructing the life of Christ or the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ, you really have to go through the crucifixion first. And in fact, Mel Gibson, in his notorious movie, The Passion of the Christ, in fact, only treats of the crucifixion and goes into all the gory details, and then gives you a 3-second glimpse of Christ rising from the tomb. It's as if he wasn't interested in resurrection at all. He was only interested in torture and death, you know, which makes, I guess, The Passion of the Christ the ultimate Good Friday movie, but it certainly doesn't make it a great Easter movie.
Right.
But Easter tends to be treated in the epilogues to the lives of Christ. But can you think of too many secular Easter movies? It doesn't lend itself to secular treatment.
No.
While Christmas lends itself to a secular treatment. Now, why is that? Well, you can't celebrate the basis of Easter without going into the life of Christ. Christmas, well, you're supposed to go into the birth of Christ, but people can take that for granted and carry over the idea of renewal, a transformation of the spirit. Because Christ comes into the world, we've got a second chance. And therefore, in most Christmas movies, even if they never mention religion, they're always second chance movies of one kind or another.
Like It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's the ultimate example, and that's the example that pops into everybody's minds. Of course, if you're thinking of literature and movies, there's The Christmas Carol, which is the big second chance story,
and
too.
And there's great movies of that.
And great movies of it, too. So it's when we're talking about movies, we're really talking about second chance movies. Well, when it comes to The Christmas Carol, for those of us who love Dickens, there's only one version of it that we accept fully.
And Let's talk about that.
That's the Alistair Sim 1951 British film. This gets a little confusing when it comes to titles, because when it was released in 1951 in England, it's called Scrooge, not A Christmas Carol. Okay, so it comes over here, crosses the pond, comes to America, opens, but it's retitled A Christmas Carol. Now it gets even more confusing because as the years go by and A Christmas Carol gets on DVD and is restored and digitally remastered, they go back to the original title because the people who remastered it are scrupulous about the original. So they give it the original title of Scrooge.
Okay.
So if you're looking for a good remastered DVD, look for Scrooge starring Alistair Sim.
And what's so good about it, Richard?
Well, there's two things, and they're opposite things. Number one, it's faithful to the book, almost in a page-by-page way. But number two, it's not quite faithful. It adds a little bit to the original story. You know, in adaptations of great novels, they always cut, cut, cut.
Yeah.
David Lean's great versions of Great Expectations and Oliver Twist, 80% of the book is gone. It has to be. Those are huge books.
Yeah.
But with Christmas Carol, nice, brief, 75-page novella, the director and the scriptwriter could add to the story. The scriptwriter, by the way, is a very interesting guy. Noel Langley is his name. He was a veteran British scriptwriter who briefly went, I don't know how briefly, but for a few years went to Hollywood and was the scriptwriter of, guess what, Wizard of Oz. Another film that's often shown at holidays, Thanksgiving or Christmas.
Wow, right.
A very skillful writer, devoted to Dickens apparently, because when he finally got a chance to direct around 1953-54, he chose to do A Pickwick Papers. He's not so skillful a director as he is a writer, and that not, you know, Pickwick Papers, it's like 1,000 pages long. Yeah. And what he really did was to do scenes from Pickwick Papers. And it's a little too exaggerated. It could have been done better, but it's not a bad movie. It's worth looking at. They cut out all the Christmas scenes from the novel, which is too bad. But anyway, back to Christmas Carol. Yeah. He wrote that, did a wonderful job of being faithful to it and unfaithful to it. The thing that's unfaithful about it, and skillfully unfaithful, is that it fills in the psychology of Scrooge. It makes it clear, as the novel does not, that Scrooge's birth killed the mother. The mother died in childbirth. And the father always held it against Scrooge. And that's why Scrooge was always badly treated by his father, sent to school, left at school, until his older sister persuaded the father to bring him home.
Wow.
So it adds that. Everybody who knows the movie well thinks that's in the novel. Well, all you have to do is go back to the novel and you'll see that there is trouble indicated between father and son, but Dickens is not clear about it. And his birth caused the death of the mother, as so many women in those days did die in childbirth. Langley goes even further with this idea.
Can I interrupt just to ask whether these are potential spoilers to the enjoyment?
Well, look, if you can spoil Christmas Carol, you don't deserve to be the audience. I mean, come on, Christmas Carol is in our bones.
I'm too nice.
And too many people have seen this version of Christmas Carol.
All right, so what
Carol.
Is the added other
but
thing?
But the added other thing is that he follows through on the idea of a woman dying in childbirth. Later, Scrooge's beloved older sister, who got him home for the holidays when he was a little boy. His sister marries somebody, has a child, Fred, the nephew of Scrooge, and she dies in childbed. And therefore, Scrooge always holds it against Fred. So that is explained in the movie, too. And Fred, of course, is completely puzzled by this. He says, why don't you come and eat with us, and, you know, Uncle Ebenezer? And Scrooge never explains that to the boy, but he harbors in his heart. And it's the ghost of Christmas past who points out the parallel to Scrooge. Your sister died in childbed just as your mother did in bearing you, Ebenezer, and therefore, and at that point, Alistair Sim, who plays Scrooge, is just, well, this Alistair Sim's performance justifies all this. It may be that people think, some people might hold it against the movie and say, oh, why all this psychologizing about Dickens, for crying out loud? He didn't put it in the book. But it gives Alistair Sim more to do, and it drives home the tragic side of A Christmas Carol, which is there in the book. And when Sim hears The Ghost of Christmas Past point out the parallel between the two women dying and the way he's held it against his nephew, just the way his father held it against him, the way Sim registers with his face, the torment and the guilt that comes into his face prepares the way for his conversion.
You're listening to a chat with our resident film critic, Richard Oliva, who writes for the Catholic Journal Commonweal, talking about his favorite Christmas movies on DVD. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, now in its fifth year of coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community programming that matters. Back in a moment with more from Richard Oliva.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510. Thank you.
May I welcome you to Christmas morning!
It's in the singing of a street corner choir. It's going home and getting warm by the fire. It's true, wherever you find love, it feels like Christmas. A cup of kindness that we share with another. A sweet reunion with a friend or a brother.
In all the places you find love, it feels like Christmas.
It is the season of the heart. a special time of caring, the ways of love made clear. And it is the season of the Spirit. The message, if we hear it, is make it last all year.
I love the Muppets Christmas Carol with Michael Caine and all the Muppets. But that's a wonderful deconstruction of the book, because the Muppets talk about the Christmas Carol even as they act in it, and make fun of the book even as they do it. And I have to admire Michael Caine's performance. Not that it is as great as Alistair Sims. It doesn't convey the emotional power. He doesn't have a chance to.
Is he played by a Muppet?
No, it's Michael Caine, is Scrooge.
Everybody else is a Muppet.
But I have to admire Michael Caine because, you know, the essence of acting is reacting. You act with your fellow human actors, and you look at the expressions on their face and the intonations in their voice, and you use that as a springboard for your next delivery of a line or your next facial expression. And Michael Caine can't do this because he's surrounded by puppets. But I have to admire him. He drives through the movie giving out as much expression as he can, acting with Muppets and treating them as his fellow human actors.
It's a
triumph of craftsmanship over circumstances.
And it's available on DVD.
Oh, that is very available on DVD. In fact, my daughter gave it to me last Christmas.
Oh, good.
She knew I liked it very much. But for emotional power and for really revealing all the dimensions of the book, you have to go to the Alistair Sim.
Including version. Dimensions that aren't in the book.
Including things, yeah. Right. But which add to this story?
I'm embarrassed now that it never occurred to me to wonder why Scrooge was such a pill.
Mm-hmm. Well, the filmmakers, the director Brian Desmond Hurst and the scriptwriter Noel Langley, hashed this out apparently and decided that we can add something to the story without spoiling it. But everything else is so faithful to the book. I have to note one change, though, which is very interesting, especially if we're going to talk about Bill Murray's Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah.
In Alistair Sim's Christmas Carol, as I say, it's very faithful. But at one point, Christmas Past takes Scrooge to his long-lost love, the wife who left Scrooge because he had become a miser and a misanthrope.
Yeah.
And she leaves him because of that. And sure enough, the movie takes her to what she is now, a woman in late middle age, gentle, handsome, and working in a shelter for paupers and homeless people. And it, just as you would imagine she would. But in the book, she's remarried. She's got another family. She left Scrooge, but she went off with another man, married, divorced Scrooge, of course, which isn't shown in the book, but of course she had to divorce him, married another man, had several children, is surrounded by her family at the end of the Christmas Past episode. The book never goes back to this. She has served her purpose, and they never talk about this long-lost love of Scrooge again. It's just another thing that illustrates what he did to himself.
Does the book have her working in the poorhouse?
No.
Huh.
It's the movie that changed that, the Noel Langley Alistair Sim version that changes that. Interestingly, the Bill Murray movie, Scrooged, with an E-D at the end, picks up on that Alistair Sim version instead of the book.
Yes.
And Karen Allen playing the lost love
so
of
lovely.
Bill Murray, still lovely, still young, and is working in a homeless shelter, I think with Aretha Franklin, actually, as one of her co-workers. And what's really novel about Scrooge is that Bill Murray in I think it's the Christmas Present episode. He goes down, because she's still working in the shelter, so she's in Christmas Present. So he goes down to the shelter, and Aretha Franklin immediately takes him to be a homeless person and throws a blanket around him and tries to administer comfort to him. And he's crazily doing a Richard Burton imitation because one of the bums in the shelter, played by Michael J. Pollard, mistook him for Richard Burton. And Bill Murray immediately launches into a Richard Burton impersonation. It's just crazy. But what's significant is that they keep Scrooge's lost love in the story, in Christmas present, as well as in Christmas past. So part of the redemption of Scrooge in this is that he gets his girlfriend back.
Yes, it's a romantic comedy.
It's rom-com, right? As well as being Dickens.
A little extra for your...
And of course, as I suppose most of your audience knows, Scrooge is in the 1980s in New York City and not in 1840s London.
Yeah.
It's a delightful movie. You don't go to it for a faithful adaptation of Dickens, but it has delightful touches in it. I particularly cherish the moment when... Bill Murray as Scrooge is out in the street of New York, and they're playing, and some musicians are playing Christmas music, and he's saying, yeah, get these bums out of here, these no-talent street players out of here. And who are the musicians? Paul Schaefer, Miles Davis.
Oh my God.
And two other well-known jazz people. And Bill Murray is saying, we get these no talent, no accounts out of here. We don't want them playing in front of the NBC building. The movie is full of wonderful, wonderful touches like that. But I'd like to point out, before we leave Christmas here, I'd like to point out something that my daughter was able to point out when she was only about 10 years old. Scrooge, at the climax of the book and all faithful versions of it, he's in the graveyard and he knows the name on the tombstone. He knows it's going to be Ebenezer Scrooge, but he doesn't want to look at it until the ghost forces him to look at it. And why doesn't he want to tell himself that it's his name on the tombstone? He knows he'll die. It's just common sense. But Before that, he heard talk about this person who died, who nobody has a good word for. He doesn't want to see that it is he himself that has been abandoned by humanity. He knows he'll die. He doesn't fear that. He fears that he will be the person that has been rejected by all humanity because he has rejected all humanity. Right. Well, in Scrooge with Bill Murray, they're in a crematorium. And he is being mourned by his brother, who's weeping tears for his lost brother. And Bill Murray jumps, the invisible Bill Murray, as the invisible Scrooge, jumps on the coffin or whatever it is they send into the heat to be cremated. And it's as if he's trying to stop his own death. And as my daughter pointed out, that makes no sense. And it's not only untrue to the story, but it doesn't make any sense. Charles Dickens, who wasn't only inspired, but also had a lot of common sense about what to do with the story, he pointed out that what Dickens is trying to do is trying to show that the rejection of humanity is worse than any death. That's the death of the spirit. What Scrooge does at the end is seemingly trying to stop his own death, as if he reforms, he will live forever.
Yes. You know? This is why my husband can't bear time travel movies.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
There's always something that collides with, reality.
Yeah.
How can this be?
Yeah.
Is that her complaint that he can't be both in the box and jumping on it?
Well, his spirit can be jumping on the box, but her complaint is, what is he trying to stop?
She's deep. For a 10-year-old.
Well, she did. We did read her the story. She did understand that what Scrooge is afraid of is this exile from humanity. And then the Bill Murray version doesn't get that at all. But never mind, it's a great movie.
Right.
So those are the three I recommend. Alistair Sim for faithfulness.
Okay.
And more than faithfulness. The Bill Murray version for just delightful rom-com adapted from Dickens. And some wonderful performances in it, too. And the Muppet movie for your kids, but also to... The sheer silliness of it.
What's
is
the
delightful.
Title of that one? Is it
The Muppet Christmas Carol?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, great.
But here we spend a lot of time on Christmas Carol. I guess It's a Wonderful Life is really just Christmas Carol in reverse, isn't it? Because Christmas Carol, Scrooge is shown how miserable you have made yourself and the people around you by having lived the life you live. and It's a Wonderful Life shows how miserable people would be had you never lived. So it's just the reverse.
Wow.
Of Christmas
Carol. I never
Carol.
Thought about it that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, the movie makers, Frank Herbert, definitely did want to make an American Christmas Carol. He found, and this is reproduced in the book that Jeanine Basinger mm-hmm. did about It's a Wonderful Life. Capra found a large Christmas card which contained an entire story on it. It's by a writer called Philip Van Doren Stern. And the only other thing I know about it is he edited an anthology of Edgar Allan Poe, which I had as a child. Huh. That's the only thing I know about Philip Van Doren Stern. But he wrote the original story about 12 paragraphs long, which is just our hero, who will be played by James Stewart, standing on a bridge, being approached by a stranger who is obviously an angel, and told what your town would be like without you. And the hero repents and doesn't throw himself off the bridge. End of story. It's about 12 paragraphs long.
Huh.
Out of this, Frank Capra, with his script writers, spins a 2.5-hour movie. And which
are you a fan?
I am a fan. I wasn't when I was a boy because I never got past the first scene. The first scene is Clarence the angel talking to, I guess, St. Peter or whoever yeah, yeah. is in charge of the angels. And they are stars up in the sky. And when Clarence speaks, one star twinkles. And when St. Peter speaks, another star. And I thought, this is crap.
Even then you were a critic.
I was 15 years old, wow. and I turned off the TV
okay.
and retreated to a volume about Fellini or Ingmar Bergman. This is how obnoxious I was as a junior film critic. But a friend of mine got me to look. He said, don't judge it by the first scene.
Yeah.
Get beyond that. By the time it got to its third scene, I was captivated. And
yeah.
I could see the incredible skill Capra showed in developing the story and in getting one of the best performances out of James Stewart that he ever
yes.
did. And not only Stewart, but Donna Reed is unappreciated
yes.
for her quiet, understated performance.
Yeah.
And the guardian angel thing, the Clarence thing, is jolly enough to put up with. But we're really constant.
You know what's really yeah. kind of almost disturbing is that business with the pharmacist, Mr.
Oh,
Gower.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes. My wife.
It's poison, I tell you. It's poison.
And he slaps the boy
yeah,
on his
on
bad
his
ear.
Oh.
Which has
or
been,
does that cause the bad
ear? No. The bad ear is caused by almost drowning in icy water.
Oh, right. From saving the brother.
From saving the brother. And with the bad ear, he has that scene in The Druggist, and the druggist slugs him on the ear, which causes further deafness. The audience, my wife and I were watching this in a theater, and my wife just jumped out of her seat. She just winced at that. And then the rest of the audience, this is the value of watching a movie with a big audience than watching it at home. I saw the audience wince when that happened.
They recoiled.
Yeah. The movie is full of pain, just as
yes.
Christmas Carol is, but perhaps more pain because James Stewart has a happy family. He has children that love him. But when that loss of the money occurs midway in the movie,
yeah.
he explodes with fury and
yes.
with frustration because, and you are reminded after all, that after all, he is not only frustrated because of the loss of money, but because he has always wanted to travel and have adventures
yes.
in the world. And here he is caught in a small town, doing his job, winning the love of all the townspeople, but now he's going to go to jail on behalf of them because he's...
Because of Uncle Billy.
Because of Uncle Billy losing the money. But the money he made simply by keeping the savings and loan going to benefit the townspeople. So because of the benefit for them, now he's in big trouble. And Stewart's acting in that episode when he expresses his frustration and yells at his children
yes, yes.
is... I mean, this is the James Stewart we've come to appreciate lately, not the drawling yokel who can outwit the city slickers, you know, not the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington James Stewart, but the Wonderful Life James Stewart and the Vertigo James Stewart and the Anatomy of a Murder James Stewart and the westerns he made for Anthony Mann James Stewart, a man who can express hatred as well as love, frustration.
And there's a restraint. I'm thinking of that scene where he's at the table with his dad.
Yes.
And his father wants him to take over the business. And you just sense the hopelessness in this guy.
Wonderful scene.
Yeah.
Wonderful scene. And beautifully underplayed by both of them.
Right.
Both understanding the love each feels for the other and understanding the hopes of each and willing to countenance those hopes. But at that point, the Jimmy Stewart character cannot give up on them.
Yeah.
But he knows how he's hurting his father. And by the way, that druggist who slugs him on the ear, who is that actor? Do you know?
Mm.
I do. It's H.B. Warner, who played Jesus Christ in the King of Kings, directed by Cecil B. DeMille back in 1927. And now, 19 years later, he's playing this alcoholic, bereft widower in Wonderful Life.
Oh, I got to look
just a little tidbit.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm going to look up the images on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
One issue that my husband has with It's a Wonderful Life, I wonder if you have a similar one, is that mean Mr. Potter never gets his comeuppance.
Everybody complains about that. And a young African-American student interviewing, being part of an audience that was interviewing Frank Capra in the 1960s, I think, got up and spoke to Capra, said, "I love your movie, Mr. Capra. It's one of my favorite films. But one thing I've always held against it was that you don't do anything to that villain Potter at the end. I wanted to whoop his ass at the end." And Capra simply said, "Look, if you have to be Potter, that's punishment enough."
Oh.
You can read about this in the Jeanine Bessinger book about It's a Wonderful Life.
Wow.
But she reproduces the transcript of the exchange.
Wow.
I think it was maybe at AFI in Washington. I'm not sure. But that's an interesting. But everybody complains about that. But the answer, his answer is really irrefutable. I mean, if you, perhaps the worst, we're talking about this on the day that Charles Manson has died. If you had to be Charles Manson, I won't say that was punishment enough, but that man must have lived in a hell of his own, as well as perpetrating hell on others. And Potter, not Charles Manson, but Potter, though not as bad, is has to live in his own hell, too.
Okay.
So I guess we'll have to accept that. But for the purpose, I can see I can hear the disappointment in your voice.
Well, I'm just trying to be a more compassionate person, and it's hard.
It's movie melodrama, and there's a melodramatic side to It's a Wonderful Life, does demand punishment of villains. But Capra did not
didn't succumb to that.
But again, it's a Wonderful Life. It's a peculiar kind of reform. The James Stewart character is obviously a good man right from the start. But what has to be reformed in him is that he has to realize that he has encountered his ultimate happiness not in travels abroad, but in the town that frustrated him so much. So there's the reform. There's the second chance.
Mm.
He gets a new lease on life because he gets a new view of what his place is in the community.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think all Christmas movies that are worth anything are about this kind of renewal, the second chance. Christ coming in the world, giving us a second chance, means that some story set in Christmas should be about a hero getting a second chance.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Commonweal DVD critic Richard Oliva about his picks for Christmas movie watching. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you for the fifth year from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Richard.
There's no listener-supported community radio without listener support. Donate online at WESUFM.org.
What's this?
This is the North Pole.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. Where's the snow?
Why are you smiling like that?
I just like to smile. Smiling's my favorite.
Make work your favorite. That's your favorite, okay?
Okay.
Work is your new favorite.
Fine.
Time for the announcement.
Okay.
Okay, people. Tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh, my God! Santa here? I know him. I know him.
A lot of Christmas movies don't fulfill this because they just monkey around with the myths of Christmas. There's some entertaining films just about Santa Claus and fooling around with the myth of Santa Claus. I mean, there's A Miracle on 34th Street, which I have never liked, but millions do, so who am I to contradict millions? There's Elf.
Well, say why you don't like it.
Well, I don't like it because it's about this greedy little girl whose ultimate happiness... I mean, let's keep in mind, this greedy little girl, played by Natalie Wood, the daughter of Maureen O'Hara, is frustrated in her life because she only lives in a comfortable, spacious Manhattan apartment which overlooks 34th Street, where the Thanksgiving parade is, with her mother in a high-paying job at Macy's, with her having access to all the toys in Macy's, all the delights of New York City, all the Broadway shows she can go to on her mother's paycheck. And here's this little girl who's deeply, deeply frustrated and unhappy because... Is it because her divorcee mother hasn't remarried and hasn't given her a father? Is that why? No. It's because she doesn't live in a big house in the suburbs. I'd like to strangle that little girl. That is not one of my favorite movies. The stuff with Kris Kringle thinking he is the real Santa Claus is... moderately entertaining and well played by Edmund Gwynn. But even that ends on a sour note. You discover he's not Santa Claus. He's just an old man in a nursing home at the end. And he's reconciled to that. There's something that just gets on my raw. Right. I just don't like the movie.
Well, you're allowed. What else have you got there on
Well, there's same notebook. Things of monkeying around with the myth of Santa Claus. There's Elf, which is really kind of delightful.
Why? I've never seen it. I know I have a family of friends who love it.
Well, it's Will Ferrell. As a little boy, he's lost and adopted by the... don't ask me how they get a hold of him, but the tribe of elves at the North Pole find him and bring him up as an elf. And he thinks he is an elf, although he grows up to be 6'2", Will Ferrell. He learns he doesn't belong there, so he goes to New York City to discover his real father, who turns out to be James Caan and is a big-time book publisher. What a losing profession that is if you want to be a millionaire or a billionaire. But anyway, there's some delightful skits in the movie, although the story doesn't make any sense at all. Then there's my chief guilty pleasure, and I really feel ashamed of myself for liking this movie. There's Fred Claus. I don't make any claims for it as a good movie, but it never fails to crack me.
Is this the brother
up.
Of Santa?
This is the older brother of Santa.
And what's his story?
His story is simply that he is the loser older brother of a very successful brother. Okay. Who could be more successful than Santa Claus?
Right.
So he tries to make a success for himself while envying his brother. And at one delightful point, he joins a therapy group of all unsuccessful brothers of big successes. And the group has the real people in it.
No.
It has the
Billy
real...
Billy Carter?
No, it has Clinton's brother. Bill Clinton's brother is
wow.
in it. And the real brother of Bill Clinton. And the real brother of Sylvester Stallone. And they are there in the therapy group expressing their frustration
Fantastic.
At their brother's success. Vince Vaughn plays Fred Claus, and He's a wonderful comic actor. And I guess he's mostly the reason why the movie cracks me up. It's not a great movie.
Okay. You know?
It's a guilty pleasure of mine, and it's a very, very good piece of trash, which we'll be lenient toward at Christmas. But there is a movie, a couple of movies I want you to consider, because one of them is popular enough, but is not considered a Christmas movie. Your acquaintance, Colin McEnroe, once made the point on one of his shows that almost any movie can be a Christmas movie if it's set at Christmas. I don't agree, but there are movies that should be regarded as Christmas movies that aren't known as that. And my favorite in that group is About a Boy, a fairly popular movie with Hugh Grant.
Okay.
Only two or three scenes from it are set at Christmas, and yet those are key scenes in the movie. And the final scene is, again, set at Christmas time. And it is a renewal, a story of renewal, told in a completely comic way. Beautifully done.
It's a comedy.
It's a comedy, and it's not a guilty pleasure of mine. It really is a superb, superb film, directed and written by fraternal filmmakers, Chris and Paul Weitz. They're not distinguished filmmakers except for this movie. They worked on the Golden Compass adaptation and a few other films, but this film is really, really, really terrific. It's adapted from a great book by Nick Hornby.
Mm-hmm.
It changes the focus of the book quite a bit, but it's as good as the book. A young man, not so young, a guy in his 30s, played by Hugh Grant, who's tired of dating beautiful young women with whom he finally has to break up because he's a commitment phobe, and always fears the moment when he'll have to try to dump them and they bawl him out for it. There's a wonderful montage that shows a whole series of women denouncing him for his caddishness. And then one day when he's just about to do this, a single mom whom he's been dating dumps him. And she does it very nicely, saying, "I've just had such a hard time with marriage that I'm not ready to marry you." He's never had any intention. "I'm not ready to marry you, and therefore I think we should split up for a while. Please don't hate me for this." He loves this because she's doing the dumping and he's not embarrassed anymore. So he joins a self-help group of single moms, divorced, widow, or simply single moms. And he's the only man in the group. And he presents himself as a man who was deserted by his harsh, cruel, calloused wife. And all the women in the group, and they're all beautiful, of course, since this is a rom-com, they all feel compassion for him. But the son, the boy of the title, About a Boy, the son of one of the women in the group sees right through him. But the boy wants his mother to date him anyway, because this bachelor that Hugh Grant plays is a pretty cool guy, wears all the right clothes, listens to all the right music, has all the right stuff in his apartment, stereos and this and then, and computer games and so forth. And he wants to be with this guy, this cool guy. He wants him as a kind of stepfather. And so, even though Hugh Grant does not hit it off with the mother at all, he hits it off with the boy, and they become not father and son, but just layback buddies. And he tries to instruct the boy in what is cool, which is a hopeless task. This poor boy is just a hopeless nerd. And finally, Hugh Grant has to suspend his detachment from humanity enough to really become fatherly to the boy, to spare him from the taunts of bullies, and almost all his classmates are bullying him. So Hugh Grant, in a way, does become a kind of father to this boy. Along the way, he takes up with a beautiful woman who is not the mother of the boy, but just a beautiful woman who would like him to grow up, and he grows up by being a kind of father to this boy. The key scenes take place at Christmas, and this again is a renewal movie.
Yes.
And I would recommend it as viewing at Christmas. It's really a really good comedy. It's really terrific and touching. And life size, not one of these Will Ferrell burlesques, where people are doing everything but slipping on banana peels. This is a really human comedy, really life size comedy. So I would recommend that. And in conclusion, I'd like to recommend my favorite modern Christmas movie of all. And I have to tell you that it is unavailable in any form in this country. But if you go to England, try to buy a DVD of it, although British DVDs will not work on American DVD machines.
You have to buy the machine, too.
All I can hope for is that this movie I love, Comfort and Joy, it's really a Scottish film directed by a great filmmaker who won prizes in Scotland but could not make it in America, Bill Forsyth. He made this extraordinary film, which is famous in Great Britain and in Scotland, but almost unknown here, released in 1984 in this country. Starring Bill Paterson, playing a guy called Alan Bird, who's a radio personality. This ought to please you. He's a radio personality, very good reputation, very popular in his home city. And it slips my memory as to whether it takes place in Edinburgh or Glasgow. I think it's Edinburgh.
Okay.
But anyway, he's strictly a city personality. At Christmas time, right on Christmas Eve, his girlfriend walks out on him. He's desolated.
That's harsh.
He's desolated. And instead of moping and feeling sorry for himself, he feels that the only way he can get over his desolation is by doing good out in the world. He gets a tape recorder. This is 1984. So he's walking around with a tape recorder, looking at the sights and sounds of the city, saying, "Yes, but do we see the real city? What corruption lies underneath it?" He's hoping to do a 60-minute expose, but nothing comes his way. Instead, he discovers a feud going on between two branches of the same Italian-Scottish family. And by the way, Scotland has a fairly large Italian population, Italian-Scottish population.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, think of the actor Tom Conti, one of the best British actors. He's Scottish-Italian.
Huh.
Anyway, he discovers a feud between these two branches of the family. They're ice cream manufacturers and sellers. One of the family rides around in a truck. It's like a good humor.
Mm-hmm.
And the truck is assaulted by the other branch of the family for reasons that are at first obscure. You learn about them a little bit later. Bill Paterson, as the hero, Dickie Bird is his disc jockey's name. Dickie Bird decides to become the Henry Kissinger of Edinburgh.
This can only end badly.
For a while, it seems to. I won't give away the ending, just to say that it has a happy ending, but that the real revelation comes not in his diplomacy between the two families, but once he has resolved all that trouble with the family, and I'll let the future viewer discover that for himself or herself. The real revelation comes afterwards when his best friend, a doctor who occasionally works in the nursing home, takes him to this nursing home for elderly people, and they all know him. He thought his job was just the most unimportant job in the world. But when he comes to the nursing home, they all know him there, and he's been the chief comfort of elderly people who have lost their vision, whose families don't visit them. He has become part of their family without him knowing it. And this convinces him that the work he's been doing all along as a disc jockey has been the real work of his life, his real vocation, and not all this nonsense about being the Henry Kissinger of Edinburgh.
Wow.
At the end, he's all alone in the radio station, as we are at the moment.
Yes.
The guy from whom he's just taken over the microphone wishes him Christmas, walks out, and Dickie Bird on the microphone, broadcasting to Edinburgh, says, falsely that he has in front of him a delicious Christmas pudding. He doesn't. That the studio is beautifully decorated. It isn't. That he's going to go home after this to his family and friends. He has no family and friends. But he's just feeling great, great, great at Christmas, and that he wants to share his happiness with you out there in the audience. And now I'm wishing you, as I dig into my Christmas pudding, a merry, happy Christmas. And that's the end of the movie.
Wow.
And it's just one of the most delightful Christmas movies ever, ever made. And it's now complete. If you want to see scenes from it, it is on YouTube.
Okay.
In scenes.
That's something.
But I have to warn you, when you take scenes from this movie, it seems just kind of, the scenes appear to be just kind of twee.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just kind of cute and a little lacking in energy. If you see the entire movie, it culminates.
We've got to get this movie.
Yeah.
Is it based on a book? Can we at
no,
least read?
No. Written for the screen by Bill Forsyth and directed by Bill Forsyth, whose career in Hollywood fizzled, even though Robin Williams was a booster of him. And many actors wanted to work with Bill Forsyth because he was just a delightful comedy creator, but a very understated, dry kind of comedy that... He just couldn't succeed at all in making a Hollywood hit with this kind of understatement. But his classics are Gregory's Girl, Comfort and Joy, and a wonderful movie starring Burt Lancaster, although it's a British film, Local Hero, which is kind of a cult film with many, many people.
I feel like I remember that.
Yeah. Colin McEnroe, I was about to say, is a great fan of that particular film. So,
okay. Well, then it must be good. We only have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
I can't resist asking you to explain to our listeners, as you did in a very terse email to me, why you won't be seeing the animated feature, The Star.
Well, number one, I'm not 3 years old anymore. Number two, I'm now the critic emeritus of Commonweal. I retired from the full-time position, so I don't have to see it. And I don't even know as a full-time critic I would have to see it, because they were not cruel editors there. And this movie strikes me, just from the previews, I could be wrong, it just strikes me as the usual animated buffoonery, making the nativity story palatable to little kids. So who becomes the hero of the story? Not Saint Joseph, not Mary, not even the wise men. It's the animals, the camel and the sheep and story. And I want to add that there is a movie called The Nativity Story, released about 12, 15 years ago, which is a very very straightforward and simple account of the nativity story made by a female director, Catherine Hardwicke, I think is her name. And she got the assignment because she had made a previous film called 13 about a young teenage girl getting kind of wild and regarded with disapproval by her mother, played by Holly Hunter. And on the basis of that, she got to make the Nativity Story, which is all from the point of view of the 13 or 14 or 15-year-old Mary, and really empathizes nicely with Mary and this very strange thing that is happening to her at Christmas, at the first Christmas. And if you want a good film for older kids, you know, it's like a PG-13 film, show your 11-year-old or your 12-year-old that one, and not The Star. Although I may be misjudging it.
I'm going to see it.
All right.
Thank you, Richard.
Before
we wrap up, though, I want to maybe make a program note that the next time you and I talk will be soon, because we need to talk about Lady Bird.
Yes.
Has a Catholic theme.
Yes.
The Novitiate.
Yes.
And I heard something on NPR about a film called Three Billboards.
Yeah,
which has a Catholic element.
It might. I don't know if it does. I haven't seen any of these films yet, but it's definitely Novitiate for showing the dark side and Lady Bird for showing the lighter side of Catholicism.
Something to look forward to.
Really something to look forward to. A Lady Bird looks like a delightful film. The director went to a Catholic school, as you know from listening to the Terry Gross interview.
Yeah.
But has never become a Catholic herself, but has a more positive view of the Catholic Church than a lot of recent directors have had.
Look for it or listen for it in January, folks. Thanks, Richard. Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you.
That was a visit with Richard Oliva, who now exclusively reviews DVDs for the Catholic Journal Commonweal, talking about his favorite Christmas films. Tis also the season for WESU's twice-yearly pledge drive. This year, it's being Reasonably Catholic's fifth birthday. I'm inviting listeners to donate any amount with a five in it. Thanks in advance for helping. That's all for this episode of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. If you missed any of the episode, you can find it posted later tonight at reasonablycatholic.com. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Spilled Milk with Charlotte, and then Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's the nicest thing that anyone's ever done for me.